Good evening. Are there a few people here for the first time? Welcome, welcome, welcome. Let me digress. I'm going to talk about a koan tonight. And those are usually teaching stories that pull you in two directions. Is it this or is it that? And the answer is usually someplace in the middle. And things like this happen in real life. And my digression is that I'm the union steward for my small union at work. And for the couple of hours this afternoon, I had to take sides, you know. I'm not a good union steward because I go back and forth. And sometimes the boss makes a good point, and sometimes my union sibling makes a good point, and I'm just all over the place. They're koans that take me a long time to figure out. And so that's where my head's been in this. Is it this? Is it that? Where's the middle? And that's the answer to this koan. The third case in the Blue Cliff record, Master Ma is unwell. Master Ma was unwell. The superintendent of the temple inquired of the master, "How is your health?" The master replied, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." These koans always have an opening paragraph called the pointer that sometimes points you in a direction of how to think about the koan. The pointer for this one says, "The great function appears without abiding by fixed principles. The intent is that you will realize something transcendental. It covers the sky and the earth, yet it cannot be grasped." So this great function, this vital dance of the universe, is not something you can try to understand with a fixed idea or with getting too many books out and wrestling with concepts. It says that it'll appear to you if you don't abide in fixed principles. If you can let everything in, give everything a little consideration, don't hold on to anything too tightly. Let things go pretty easily. And of course that's a pretty good description of our sitting meditation, our zazen, where as thoughts come up, you just look at them and then let them go and come back to your next breath. So that's a clue on understanding this total dynamic functioning of the universe. Let it all in. Don't reject anything. Let everything abide, you know, with equal weight. So we have Master Ma who's unwell. Some of the stories about this koan is that Matsu was on his deathbed. He was really unwell. And so that he replied about his health, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. The sun-faced Buddha is, and the moon-faced Buddha are two names of the Buddha. I think the sun-faced Buddha might be Vairochana. Vairochana, it says, means one who looks like the sun. But I won't go into that. Vairochana, the Dharma body of the Buddha. But the sun-faced Buddha lives 1,800 years, and the moon-faced Buddha only a day and a night. And Master Ma says about his health, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, please consider both of them. You know, we've got sun-faced Buddhas and moon-faced Buddhas in our life. Maybe our partners, our significant others who are with year after year, maybe they're teaching us day after day for 1,800 years. They're giving us their teaching. And maybe you'll meet somebody on the street and they'll say something that really makes you think, and you've never met them before. Maybe they're the moon-faced Buddhas in our life. But, Catherine was here for 20 years. I saw her walking around the altar, planting incense. For 20 years, she was pointing us to the other shore, pointing us to our Buddha nature with classes on the Diamond Sutra or the Lotus Sutra or the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. She was 85 when she died 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago. Maybe that's a sun-faced Buddha. But, the last 7 days of her life, as we sat with her, watching her breath after breath in hospice care in her living room, that teaching of the great matter of life and death, that was a real moon-faced Buddha teaching. And yet they were pretty connected. All of us in the room had known her for a good long time, I think. Would we have heard the moon-faced teaching in the same way if we hadn't had the sun-faced teaching? I don't know. But so already I'm talking about not taking sides. That sun-faced and moon-faced appears in every moment. I had a little pointer to this in the spring. I took a vacation in New York City and I went to the Village Zendo in Manhattan, and the teacher there, Patricia Enkyo, talked about the sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. And she talked about those Buddhas appear in all of us in each moment. It can be a sun-faced teaching. Where we illuminate, our illumination will reach everywhere and last eons. And we're also moon-faced Buddhas. where in a flash of an instant we light up the room and take that snapshot. So there's lots of pointers that Matsu was saying. It's not about how long you live. It's the great function. It's the great matter. It's the Dharma flowing through all of us. Suzuki famously talked about this in 1968, a few years before his death. I don't think he had even been sick. But he talked about this koan, and he talked about it. He actually said to his students, when I die, it's going to be okay. It's going to be all right. He said this koan was about accepting things as it is, meaning not wanting a different reality, not wanting a different moment than just right now. And that moment can include sadness and grief. But to fully accept the moment just the way it is, not hold on to a moment that you'd like it to be. Whatever happens to Matsu, he can accept things as it is, as it happens. But we cannot always accept everything. Something we think is good, we may accept, but something we think we dislike and we don't accept, we compare things. When you sit, I say, don't think. Don't think means not to treat things in terms of good or bad, heavy or light. Just accept things as it is. Even though you do not think, you may still hear something in Zazen. And usually the moment you hear it, your reaction is, what could it be? Is that a car? It's very noisy. Maybe it's a motorcycle. So he's asking us to accept things as it is. But he gives us a little break. He says we've got this natural tendency to hold on to ideas. What is that? To try to identify things, which is a kind of grasping, holding on. Rather than just, also at Tassajara, when the blender goes off, the cook just says, noise, and to warn other people. So maybe that's a teaching in Zazen. Rather than identifying it as a car or a motorcycle, maybe we can just say, noise. Maybe that's not holding on to things so tightly. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha does not mean to be indifferent. I don't care whether it's a sun-faced Buddha or the moon-faced Buddha. That's indifference. It means whether it's the sun-faced Buddha or the moon-faced Buddha, we should enjoy it. We should just accept it. So, I'm unwell. I can identify with Master Ma. I just picked up my books and left and got this morning and got this huge twinge in my back. And it's been lingering all day. So I didn't do the prostrations tonight. But aside from that moon-faced teaching of temporary dis-ease, I've got a much longer history of suffering from a deluded mind. And I use this practice for healing, for liberation. Like Suzuki says, when those thoughts arise, you know, I should do more sit-ups and I wouldn't have this bad back. I should, you know, there's other ways to skin a cat. I can let that thought go. One of the chants we say in the morning is the way is pretty easy as long as we don't pick and choose. So I don't have to land on one side or the other. I don't have to choose right away if I'm going to support the boss in this one or my co-worker. I can mull it over. I can try to let all of that in. And I use this practice as a good reinforcer to try to accept the moment as it is and not to reject anything. I use it to heal myself from, you know, the suffering if I land on one side or another too quickly for liberation, for recovery. This disease of picking and choosing, of discriminating mind. You know, the sun-faced Buddha, is that more preferable than a moon-faced Buddha? I go to the ordinary recovery groups that we have here on Friday nights because I use this practice to recover from these delusions. Some of the people who go to that group with me have really been attached to drugs and alcohol, and they're using this practice to help them let go of those attachments. I don't have that addiction to substances. I grew up with a lot of people in my family addicted to alcohol, and I was lucky enough not to inherit that disease. But I sure spent a lot of time wishing that this moment were a little different, wishing for a better moment. And so I've got lots of practice landing on what I think would be a perfect moment, or what somebody's behavior should be. And that kind of attachment, holding on tightly, has gotten me in trouble with relationships. It's gotten me in trouble at work. It's gotten me in trouble with friends and family, in the same way that my friends that are attached to drugs and alcohol get in trouble with work and friends and family because of their attachments. So it's a good group for all of us, for our healing, for practice in acceptance of things as it is, of not wanting to have a different moment. So I've got this addiction to myself that I'm working hard on, my fixed ideas of a preferable moment. One of the things that some of us say in the group is that we introduce ourselves as, I'm Patrick and I suffer and I cause suffering. And that's what, that's the direction that I want this healing practice to address. What have I written here? I've said all that. So liberation and healing by not grasping to fixed views. The pointer calls that transcendental. You'll realize something transcendental by welcoming and not rejecting both sides, not pushing it away. When we were all sitting with Catherine in her living room, I think we were accepting of sadness, we were accepting of grief, but there was a good group of us there that had done a lot of practice. I don't think I, at least I didn't hear anybody talking about, we want this to be completely different. There was a certain acceptance that comes not only from our individual practice, but from our Dharma brothers and sisters that are supporting the practice with us. And in that way, it's a lot like the ordinary recovery meeting. We're not just talking about how in the group, how we all go to our corners and sit and learn this, accepting things as it is, not wanting another moment. We're all talking with each other and supporting each other in this practice that we get an opportunity to visit breath after breath. And that was one of Catherine's teachings, as we sat with her breath after breath, not wanting her to explain herself, not wanting her to tell us what she was doing, but just sitting with our bodies and our breath, one moment after the next. Seeing this moon face teaching and having the history of her sun face teaching of not only the 24 years she was with us, the previous 22 years with San Francisco, but her whole 85 years. Maybe I'll stop here for discussion about the sun-faced Buddhas in our life, the moon-faced Buddhas, when we are manifesting both of those aspects of our lives, and what we saw in the 24 years that Catherine taught here, what we experienced in the 7 days and nights that she was teaching us wordlessly with just her breath. Johnny.
I was touched when you said your introduction that ordinary recovery is I suffer and I cause suffering. I'm familiar with this format. The big aha for me as a result of this practice combined with that is it's a system like that. I suffer and I cause suffering only makes sense when I absorb it as I suffer and I cause my suffering, as opposed to being responsible for anybody else's suffering. But I want often to make somebody else responsible for my suffering. Mm-hmm. And I think 12 is a special number in this format, and I think it's quite enough. There may be more, but it's quite enough for me. So there are 12 hindrances I see to my own participation in Sunface Buddha, and there are 12 practices which help me to disendarken Sunface Buddha. I can't say I am going to achieve enlightenment. I sort of think if I do enough disendarkening, some light will show up that may be already there. Three of the practices that I use often relate to three, seven, and ten attached to them. And for those that are familiar with 12, 3, 7, and 10 will mean something special. But for me, it's about renunciations. And I just wonder if this resonates with the geist behind your talk tonight. In my third practice, I renounce certainty. In my seventh practice, I renounce criteria. And in my tenth practice, I renounce rationalizing. And this gets me out of the mode, particularly, of blaming somebody else for my suffering. Mm-hmm. And looking at my own upset and putting the introspection where it belongs. In my being and not somebody else's being or behavior. It's very helpful that way. In terms of Catherine, I first met her in 2007 or so. And for some reason, when our worlds joined, it didn't seem pleasant for her. And I chose at that point to disengage, to back off between 2007 and 2009, basically, and not engage in a way that gave rise to this difficulty, whatever it was. And then I had a sense that it was okay at some point, and I deliberately went someplace where she was going to be that night, and we met at a doorway. And when we met, when our worlds met, there was nothing with Sunface Buddha. I don't know what was going on in each of our worlds to create the darkening of Sunface Buddha. But after that 2-year period had elapsed, when we met each other on an intuitive basis, it was as if we'd always been joined, and there was only light, and there was only loving, and there was only full engagement and respect. And from 2009 to 2012 and the Saturday before she fell, the last time I saw her, there was only Sunface Buddha. And I think a lot of that came maybe just because I had done some work in disengaging. And I was able to meet and greet Catherine that night as if I'd never met her before.
Well, in terms of that idea of renunciation, this whole practice requires some effort, and it's not always as much fun as you've said, you know, not to just grasp onto something and go with it. There's plenty of times when I'm really sure that I'm on the right track, and I want to make a beeline that down that direction, and it's not quite as much fun to kind of pull back and say, I'm not going to hold on to that one so tightly. And maybe that is, if not an enlightened practice, at least it's not making things darker. Maybe that's your term. And so you end up coming out a little bit ahead. The whole enlightenment idea, I was just thinking if Suzuki used that. In this one paragraph, he says, to attain enlightenment means to have complete composure in our life without any discrimination. So we don't talk so much about enlightenment or great aha moments in this practice, it's nice to see him even use the term here, enlightenment, and he calls that enlightenment is just not to have that picking and choosing mind. And so when you need a little support sometimes to let go, to pull back, to hold off. And I think it was Tenshin Anderson who talked about that's why sanghas are so important, that this practice is a little bit, pushing the rock uphill sometimes. And you need to have comrades in that, and I think that's what you were addressing there. So enlightenment, then, he says, is just not to pick and choose, not to hold on tightly. Biara.
Patrick, thank you. Do you think that the sun-faced Buddha illuminates more than the moon-faced Buddha?
Well, when you meet the Dharma, when you hear the Dharma, I don't think you're really perceiving, is this coming from the long person, the long relationship in my life, or the short face, the short relationship in my life? It is just that bright light of ease. So I think that's how I experience it.
So either one.
And I want to live forever. So how can I hold, both of those?
A little preference for the sun-faced Buddha.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what you're... So, because sometimes my experience is that the sun-faced Buddha teaching, wherever it's occurring, can be quite blinding, actually. And, sometimes literally when I got in the sun, it's put, glasses on. Whereas the moon is kind of soft. And, when we were all sitting with Catherine those days, it was very soft. There was just love everywhere. There's a way that kind of soft holding of someone whom you just accept as perfect, just as they are, because they're completely guileless there. You know, they're just there. It is there. We all are lying there, breathing in and out. I mean, it's like what unifies all of us. So in the presence of that, we're sort of blown open. That's my experience of it. And maybe for some, maybe in some instances, that could be a sun face teaching, just in an instant, like you just described. I mean, it's just maybe a different kind of illumination.
Yeah, it's worth thinking about. Yeah. People have said that when we were slogging it out up there at Jokoji with the rain coming down and it's so cold and the little pot-bellied stove in the middle of this auditorium-sized zendo. And Catherine would day after day, year after year, give the lecture and make us feel that we were doing the most important thing ever. And so we would sign up for the next one. I guess I'm identifying that one as more of her sun face teaching. You know, year after year, those were the most, important moments ever, sitting in Sesshin, listening to her lectures. So I'm hearing you about the softness, the ease with which we could all sit in her living room.
With whatever was there.
Yeah.
Because in this room, I'm not sure we would all be so comfortable with that. If I was, snoring through Zazen, eventually I suspect someone would. There is a difference, in a sense, in the quality of receiving. Can we receive each other right here, on a day-to-day basis, that fully? Mm-hmm. I mean, I wish for that. And maybe that's what you were talking about Sangha, really being that big, that even that we can just accept it just as it is, whatever manifestation it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Russ. When she had been here for 3 or 4 years before I got here, and I certainly didn't have any experience before coming here of any other any other zendo, but I've heard stories of how she really adapted the forms to fit, you know, people's experience in their life, and she felt early on that the group here was not, you know, the same sangha that was at Tassajara or San Francisco, and she really simplified and adapted, and you know, over the we were actually adapting quite a bit over the years. When, you know, when things didn't work, we would make some changes, and we'd try them out for a while and see, you know, how they fit our sangha, our lives, you know, what we could do, you know, in a group that kind of shows up here 5 minutes before, you know, we should be sitting, you know, rather than at Tassajara when they could have all afternoon to prepare the zendo for a certain ceremony or for something coming up. So she had to make adaptations right from the beginning, in herself, and you know what worked here at in Santa Cruz for this community. Yeah. Yeah. And then we've actually continued to have those discussions. I think it's, you know, I have a feeling that even in the Soto Shu, there's discussions of, you know, what's realistic for our sangha in the 21st century. I have a feeling that the whole practice is malleable, and that the discussions that we have still in our practice, the practice committee, that they go on in all the practice committees all over the country and probably in Japan. Thank you. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible.